from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in our opening forum hour this morning, until this week, little was known about the legal framework the United States government operates under when ordering the killing of its citizens. But now a leaked Justice Department memo outlines the legal case for some of these attacks. Civil liberties groups decry the policy as an overreach of executive authority. The leak comes as the Obama administration's nominee for CIA director, John Brennan, a drone program supporter, is due to appear before the Senate for a confirmation hearing. We'll discuss the specifics. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. A 16-page memo, a confidential Justice Department white paper obtained by NBC News, indicates an increased use of drone strikes against al-Qaeda suspects, including making a legal case for those aimed at citizens of the United States, like the 2011 strike in Yemen that killed alleged al-Qaeda operatives Anwar al-Awlaki and Samir Khan, both American citizens. Al-Awlaki's son, a 16-year-old American citizen, was also killed in another drone attack. And the memo says high-level informed U.S. officials may determine activities that pose a threat of a violent attack. A bipartisan group of 11 U.S. senators has asked for legal justification for the use of armed drones or other counterterrorism weaponry to kill U.S. citizens. The White House defends its controversial policy as both legal and ethical. Joining us first to talk about this is Robert Wirth, who's with us from Connecticut this morning, reporter for The New York Times. Robert Wirth, good to have you on Forum. Welcome.
Nice to be here.
I guess let's begin by talking about the fact that this is being decried by the ACLU and other civil liberties groups, particularly the legal case and the secrecy connecting to questions of constitutional protections, due process, where American citizens are concerned. But it can't be coincidental that this has been leaked right before the confirmation hearings of John Brennan.
Yeah, well, among other things, I think it may allow Brennan to say a little bit more about what has been a very secret program when the hearings come up, although I think it's going to be very interesting to see how much he can say. They may have to go into closed session. This is why people are interested. I think there's been a lot of discontent with these memos that apparently, you know, justify. We haven't seen the actual memos yet, but the opinions. But justify killing American citizens. There's a lot of discontent with that, and of course, in Yemen is a whole separate question of what this is doing politically.
Well, let's talk about the key word in this memo, which is imminence. President Obama has redefined it to exclude any actual adversary attack and goes back, well, to 1967 when the Israelis felt an imminent threat from Egypt and attacked, essentially. This is essentially the argument, isn't it?
Yeah, and the trouble is that so much of the evidence is secret. I mean, in Yemen, you know, who is providing the information about who these guys are, what they're doing, you know, whether they pose an imminent threat. I mean, that, as a reporter rather than as a scholar of this, that's my question. And I don't think anybody in Yemen or the United States has a clear sense of that.
Well, things have been secretive. Even in terms of how many militants have been killed, how many civilians have been killed in Yemen, Pakistan, Somalia, for that matter. Can we expect some of this to come out in these hearings?
Well, I don't know how much specific information. He may give numbers. I'm not sure how much he's going to say, though. I think what the memo allows him to do is speak a little bit more generally about it. And it'll be interesting. I mean, he in the past has taken a very hard line, saying that there have been, you know, no civilian casualties from some of these strikes. He sort of seems to have moderated that, and it's become perfectly clear that there have been a number in Yemen and elsewhere, including very recently. So I think it'll be interesting to see to what extent he acknowledges that but explains why the program is still necessary.
Well, the memo also talks about operational heads, and yet the only evidence of somebody as an operational leader might be that former California metalhead, Adam Rahan. There's no evidence even that al-Awlaki was an operational leader.
That's true. There's been a lot of dispute about what his exact role was. The U.S. government has maintained that he had an operational role in helping to plan attacks. he clearly was in touch with Abdulmutallab, the young Nigerian who tried to carry out the bombing in late 2009 on a U.S.-bound jetliner. As I say, much of this remains sort of secret, and although they have succeeded in killing other people who were high-level people in al-Qaeda, like, for instance, Saeed al-Shifri, who apparently was killed. He was the number two, apparently was died recently from a strike that in last year, in 2012. We don't know exactly what his role has been on planning attacks on the U.S. as opposed to most of the attacks the al-Qaeda does, which are in Yemen.
We're talking, by the way, with Robert Worth, who's a reporter of the New York Times, who's been covering this story and talking about a leaked Justice Department memo that outlines a legal case for some of the attacks using drones. Let's just get your take, Robert Worth, on the fact that, well, this could theoretically, I suppose, be used against American citizens right here. There are fewer, apparently, Muslim terrorists in the United States, but U.S. citizens who joined the Axis in World War II, this would be sort of analogous, I suppose, couldn't it be?
I guess so. I can't imagine that they would use it domestically. And I'm unfortunately not familiar with, you know, any prescriptive language about how it's to be used. But, until now, we've really only seen it used in extremely lawless, dangerous places in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Yemen. And I think there would be tremendous resistance to using it, anywhere beyond those places.
Will the Obama administration, do you think, release more information to the public with the kind of pressure that's resulted from this memo? Will Congress and the courts take more action? You've got 11 senators who have banded together saying there has to be more transparency, and they've all been privy to intelligence reports.
Yep. Oh, I think Brennan's hearing is important precisely because it's an opportunity for more pressure on that front. I think you're going to see, and there's been quite a bit written about this, people have all kinds of questions they'd like Brennan to answer. And if he fails to answer them, I think there will be even more pressure.
Well, I appreciate very much your being with us. Again, Robert Worth speaking with us, reporter for the New York Times who has been covering this story. Thank you so much.
Sure, it's a pleasure.
We're going to go to South Bend, Indiana now and welcome Professor Mary Ellen O'Connell, who is professor of international law at the University of Notre Dame Law School. And Mary Ellen O'Connell, good to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Also want to welcome Glenn Solmacy, who is a professor at the U.S. Coast Guard Academy, a Homeland and National Security Law Fellow at the Center for National Policy in Washington, D.C., author of The National Security Court System. Welcome, Glenn Solmacy.
Good morning, Michael.
Good morning to you. Let me begin, if I may, Professor O'Connell, with you. The legal argument, this is just a memo, first of all, but the legal arguments from your perspective are simply totally unacceptable.
That's correct. There's really nothing surprising in this white paper, as they call it. I don't know what kind of document that is, this white paper. That's some kind of summary of the secret memo on targeted killing. But we've known a lot about the targeted killings since they were carried out in 2002. These use military force. We're using Hellfire missiles and bombs weighing up to 500 pounds. They're happening, obviously, in places where there are reporters, where facts are being gathered. So the only thing that's secret is the attempt at a legal justification, not what's actually happening. And those of us who know this law and who know it well can't find any justification in the publicly known law, and that's where law really should exist. I would disagree with Mr. Worth. I don't think that the key word is imminent. I think the key word in the paper and in what the administration has been trying to assert, the key word is battlefield. We're using military force away from battlefields. And this new white paper, the first thing that it says is that it's an attempt to justify, it's a focus on killing people, in particular Americans, who are away from hostility zones. That's a very serious crime under international law, to be using military force outside situations of armed conflict. We have very different rules pertaining to situations outside armed conflict zones. The United States is such a zone. We're not experiencing armed conflict hostilities here, and it would be, of course, very wrong for the president to order a drone strike here. Mr. Worth said that he couldn't imagine it happening on a political ground, but the other thing that is very worrying to me is that the paper builds an argument that there shouldn't be any geographic boundaries for which we use military force. The real focus seems to be on the status that the CIA suspects certain people to have. So if you're a member of Al-Qaeda or some other terrorist group ill-defined in the memo, and there's somebody in the U.S. government who thinks there's enough information about you, an attack with a missile can go forward, even if there are people around you who have nothing to do with you, who are children. And I should emphasize, the United States has killed between 200 and 300 children in these attacks in Yemen, Somalia, and Pakistan, situations that are not part of armed conflict. So that this is a very, very serious problem that we're dealing with here. And I don't see anything in the memo that gives me, as an American citizen, confidence that the president can't just say, based on the status of the underwear bomber or of the Times Square bomber, they're trying to carry out terrorist attacks in the U.S., will fire a Hellfire missile at them, even if there are people around them.
Well, the president also said that the drone attack on Al-Awlaki in Yemen was an easy decision for him, and he's got a constitutional law background. I'm wondering.
Yes, I'm sorry that it was an easy decision. That's very alarming. But I think it points to another problem that we're having right now in American history. President Obama is a constitutional law professor, and in the U.S. Constitution, it's correct that the commander-in-chief authority is very strong, but he apparently does not have the basics of public international law. And when the U.S. is using military force in other countries, as the White Paper itself acknowledges, we've got to be considering the United Nations Charter, the rules on self-defense. We have to be considering what is an armed conflict zone, also defined in international law. But this White Paper has given President Obama very poor advice, and he apparently did not have the background in his years as a law professor or in his education at Harvard to understand that he has been given poor advice. But really, do we need to have such refined knowledge or even good legal advice? I think the people I talk to understand that firing a missile or dropping a bomb outside a situation of armed conflict hostilities where the evidence is clear that fighting is going on and it is an emergency and exigent situation in which civilians flee to refugee camps, they get away. These are the situations in which military force may be used permissibly under international law. Americans understand, the people of the world understand, common sense, you don't drop bombs on houses in non-armed conflict zones.
Once again, Mary Ellen O'Connell with us from South Bend, Indiana, professor of international law at the University of Notre Dame Law School. And Professor Glenn Solmacy is also with us, professor of U.S. Coast Guard Academy. And Professor Solmacy, I keep thinking what kind of effect it would have had if this memo had come out during the Bush administration, but they also had a preemptive justification for going after weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and this seems to almost follow through. I remember Lord Goldsmith, Tony Blair's attorney general during the war in Iraq, giving a defense of imminence to Parliament. So this has a kind of lineage to it.
It does, Michael. Strangely, it seems as if it's an embracing of the Bush doctrine of preemption. But I think we have to look. I mean, Mary Ellen's thing was keep in mind, this is a draft white paper. And the Attorney General has said that, and the President has said that. Yes, there's some things in there that could cause concern, but what it really signifies is that the administration is taking the war on Al-Qaeda seriously, and that the administration is looking at this now and has evolved to the point of recognizing an armed conflict is taking place, and one that's different than any other armed conflict we've faced. And what they're trying to do is have the law catch up with technology, with new warfare, and with new ways of fighting war. And this is one way to do that. So I think this is an attempt to do that. I think there is analogies to the Bush administration's legal rationale for myriad issues in the war on terror, including really the Bush doctrine. It seems an embracing of the Bush doctrine.
But do these legal rationales really fall under a category of violating international laws? I think Professor O'Connell has said.
I think they could. I think there's certainly disagreement on both sides, but I would suggest that if you're evolving international law and customary international law to fit the needs of policymakers in the 21st century, we have to see it's an ever-changing time, and we have to look at this domestically and internationally. Domestically, Congress has given the president enormous authority under the authorization for the use of military force, developed not long after 9/11 in late September of 2001. It has not been changed, has not been updated, and allows the president to do what Mary Ellen is saying is not appropriate, going into other countries. It allows him to attack and to use force in places all over the world, and it's really a broad grant of power by the Congress to the president.
And that means places that are not hot battlefields.
Correct. Yeah. Correct, and I think we have to look, you know, this isn't the days of tanks lining up on the border or airplanes coming overhead are long gone. These people can engage in activities the equivalent of previous warfare in a modern context. Just one person can have the same results of what used to take an army to conduct operations. So we're trying to catch up with that. The two legal issues are imminence, which is very, very difficult, certainly, to determine what is imminent. But it is different from what it was back in the 18th century or 19th century. Imminence today, with technology, 24-hour news media, and other items, is a different, much, much more nuanced than it had been previously. The one that I have more problems with is the second prong, is the leadership, which Mary Ellen alluded to, and I think Mr. Wirtz did as well, is who determines who is a leader? Was Al-Awlaki actually operational, or was he a leader? Who, at what level is it? Is it the second level in the tier? Is it the third tier? Who is a leader in terms of making these attacks and also determining who is a leader? So of the two prongs, imminence for an attack as well as who is the leadership, I think the leader one is the one we have to be more conscious of. Who's making that determination is something that I think has to be explained.
Well, I'm going to invite our listeners to join this conversation, and in fact, you can do that now. Our toll-free number is available to you, and we welcome your thoughts and what you have to contribute to our discussion here this morning about the legal framework for the government operating under when it's ordering essentially the killing of its own citizens. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786, and we do welcome your phone calls. So feel free to join us. It's toll-free whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. The number to call now is 866-733-6786. A number of other ways to have your voice heard. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or you can post any questions or comments you have on our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment or go to our Facebook page or tweet us. And our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, but certainly like to hear what you have to communicate. And talking about the use of drones to essentially target Americans or use of drones in general, one of the major, of course, advocates of the use of drones has been John Brennan, who's coming up for CIA confirmation. Let me go back to Professor Mary Ellen O'Connell. Professor O'Connell, the points that Professor Solmasy has hit on here, I want to get your response to them, particularly the fact that this is a different type of war we're fighting now.
Yeah, no, Glenn makes, of course, some very good points, but let's try to sort these out and think about them in a more orderly fashion, because one of the things that I think has been done in both the Bush and the Obama administration is that we're thrown a bunch of intermixed legal arguments that in a group maybe sound plausible, but if you separate them and look at each one on its own merits, we see that this is a lot of very little, and certainly not enough to justify killing between 3,000 and 4,500 people through the use of drones outside armed conflict zones. Glenn has put his focus on imminence and leadership, but the preliminary issue is where can we use military force? We're using military force in an armed conflict in Afghanistan today at the request of Afghani leaders. We are fighting a counterinsurgency, a civil war, alongside the leadership of Afghanistan. But that war began after an attack on 9/11 that the Security Council at the UN said was a significant attack that could lead to U.S. action self-defense under Article 51. That rule of self-defense says that you can respond to an armed attack, 9/11, actual attacks, or attacks that are occurring about that you have information about. You were talking of the common example given of Egypt about to attack Israel. That those are the kinds of instances that Article 51 speaks to. And then if you can use military force to gain a defensive effect for your country, you may use that military force necessary to achieve the effect against the state responsible. Now, in my view, and this is my area of great concentration, the law of self-defense, the U.S. could fight in Afghanistan until the fall of Kabul, the Taliban leadership that had coordinated with al-Qaeda to attack this country on 9/11. But after that, it was really over. And since then, we've been fighting a civil war alongside Mr. Karzai to oppose the Taliban returning to power. So there's nothing in that situation that leads to the U.S. being able to carry out more strikes in other countries. There's not a worldwide armed conflict against al-Qaeda. That's Mr. Obama himself said in 2008, there's no such thing. The white paper tries to say that each of these little guys, these criminals like al-Awlaki, who are inciting people to criminal activity, could be themselves the equivalent of an attack on this country like Pearl Harbor or like 9/11. That is simply factually incorrect. And without those facts, we don't have a basis for attacking in those countries. There's no argument of anticipatory self-defense or imminence. All we have is, yes, the Bush Doctrine again, and I think your listeners will be very surprised to hear that what's embedded in this white paper is that the Obama administration's willing to use military force against some vague future plan to carry out a terrorist attack, which the United States has always treated until these recent attacks, as when they're separated from a sovereign state, carried out by a small criminal group, as criminal. Ronald Reagan said, don't confuse combatants, people who are fighting on the battlefield, with terrorists.
Let me go back to Glenn Solmacy on this. Professor Solmacy, I mean, Professor O'Connell has outlined this in terms of geographical locations, where, and that's the big question, along with leadership and imminence. Can I get you to address that?
And the nature of the attack.
And the nature of the attack, exactly.
No, yeah. Question. Mary Ellen's on point as always, and it's tough to argue with her on some of these, but I think we have to look even when you raise what we're talking about national self-defense, and the memo is basically saying the president is acting constitutionally and in accordance with international law when self-defense is on the line. And Mary Ellen's saying these aren't really warriors, Glenn. They're criminals. Michael, they're not necessarily – they're just a band of bandits who we're now using military force to engage and take them out. And I think we have to look at this, again, as an evolving nature of warfare and look at – when we talk about al-Awlaki, he actually was the person coordinating the underwear bomber to attack the United States. So in defense of that, if someone's orchestrating attacks against the United States, in this case we have a very specific chain to the underwear bomber, that we can go ahead now and say, time out. He had a connection to a Nigerian terrorist who flew into the United States trying to attack the United States. Now you have a legitimate part of this conflict to take him out. And I think it's very simple to take this and say these are just criminals. They weren't criminals in Libya. They're not criminals operating in Afghanistan, that were operating in Iraq. We have different areas where al-Qaeda is spread around the world, and it makes it very complex and very difficult. And I think what the white paper is doing in draft format, that, again, that was leaked in the white paper, was simply that they're trying to find a justification and to understand better what this is. And I think what we constantly are dealing with, whether it's Gitmo, whether it's actually engaging in operations, whether it was the surge, is having the law catch up to this new type of warfare. And we really haven't done it yet.
I'm also coming up on a break here, and I have to add the fact that it seems when you talk about senior operational leaders of al-Qaeda or affiliated sources, that has an ambiguity to it that's inherent in it.
No question. That's the dangerous part, is who is and who is not, who's determining that.
Well, we will hear from you, our listeners, and again, you can let us know what your thoughts are, and any questions or comments you have are welcome to this conversation. Email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. Or our Facebook page, or tweet us, our Twitter handle @KQED Forum. We spoke earlier with Robert Wirth of the New York Times, and with us for the rest of the hour, Glenn Solmacy. He's a professor of U.S. Coast Guard Academy, and Mary Ellen O'Connell, professor of international law at University of Notre Dame Law School. I'm Michael Krasny. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and until this week, little was known about the legal framework the U.S. government operates under when ordering killing of its citizens, but now a leaked Justice Department memo outlines the legal case for some of these attacks. Civil liberties groups decry the policy as an overreach of executive authority, and the leak comes as the administration's nominee for CIA Director John Brennan, a drone program supporter, is due to appear before the Senate for a confirmation hearing. We heard earlier from Robert Wirth, reporter for the New York Times, who's been covering this story. And with us by phone this morning is Mary Ellen O'Connell, professor of international law at the University of Notre Dame Law School, and Glenn Solmacy, who is professor at the U.S. Coast Guard Academy, a Homeland and National Security Law Fellow at the Center for National Policy in the nation's capital and author of the National Security Court System. And Mary Ellen O'Connell, I think you were going to add something here when we went to the break.
Yes, I'm sorry about that. I appreciated Glenn's point, and I hope the listeners noticed that he's emphasizing ideas about law of the future, that life is changing, of course, and that what is really being presented by the Obama administration and earlier the Bush administration is somehow their view of what the law should be. I have to emphasize that that's not how the law reads today. Now, the U.S. may have some claims that we need to have greater rights to use military force to bomb in more context and to attack with missiles, but we don't get to make those rules on our own. They have to be made with the international community, and as you can imagine, most of the world is not interested in expanding the occasions on which military force and hundreds and thousands of people can be killed. The world has been moving toward greater emphasis on human rights, on respecting the rights of all people, especially their right to life. So what we are seeing emphasis on outside the U.S. is moving more toward law enforcement in these complex situations, opposing terrorist groups through what works effectively, which is law enforcement and involvement in political process, attacking the underlying causes, etc. I would also point out that so many people in this country who are counterterrorism experts have said that this business of expanded use of military force beyond all sense of what the current rules are is not effective in terms of countering terrorism. We've heard from Admiral Blair, high-ranking counterterrorism official in the Obama administration, saying these drone attacks are not going to work. The RAND Corporation has a very important paper saying military force against terrorist groups does not work for long-term suppression. John Mueller, the expert from Ohio State and the Cato Institute, says that this is nonsense. We have books from Louise Richardson, who's an expert on how the IRA was ended. It's just replete, and I think your listeners are well aware of the anger that has occurred throughout the world because of the damage and destruction and killing by U.S. drones.
Well, we also have John Brennan, of course, who has been long a defender for counterterrorism purposes with this. But I wonder, Mary Ellen O'Connell, how you respond, and then I want to hear Glenn Solmacy respond to a couple of emails here. You first, if I may, Professor O'Connell. This is Carl who writes, people like Anwar al-Awlaki have expanded the battlefield to include wherever they are waging war against America. If those who are waging war against America cannot be captured because they hide in lawless parts of Yemen or Pakistan, then we have to make the call, just like the chain of command does on a regular battlefield, to kill the enemy. No judge needs to be consulted in an act of war.
I think that's giving far too much credit to Anwar al-Awlaki to say that he personally could expand the battlefield and that he's engaging with the mighty force of the United States military. I'm married to a combat veteran, and this country has the proudest armed forces in the world, of which Glenn Solmacy, of course, is a part. And I just think this is ridiculous to say that a person like Anwar al-Awlaki, who probably never handled a weapon in his life, could extend the battlefield. It was the U.S. that is extending the battlefield, and sadly, unlawfully. Mr. al-Awlaki is a low-level criminal.
Even if he was behind the underwear bombing, as we heard from...
The evidence that we have... First, of course, your listeners should not be confused. It was good police work and cooperation between the Netherlands and the United States that and fast action by people on the plane that led to the only person being harmed by the underwear bomb was the underwear bomber himself, who burned himself rather seriously with this terrible idea. But he is now being criminally charged. He is facing a trial in this country. So I'm not in any way undermining the problem of terrorism. I'm just pointing out that the way that has been effective as opposed to perhaps politically popular, is through law enforcement. And if the U.S. really wants to get a handle on terrorism, the counterterrorism problem over time, just read the work of people like Colonel Kilcullen. They are pointing out that this kind of military force doesn't work. Military force is effective against other major militaries. When the United States fought to defend Kuwait from Iraq's invasion, 100 hours of combat, that country was liberated, and that is what military force is good and successful at. It's not good and successful at these far more complex problems, social problems that lead to terrorism and that are necessary. We need sophisticated police work and cooperation. We're not getting that when we make enemies because we've killed 200 to 300 children.
Well, I need to add the footnote here because I well remember the discussions that went on when there was a movement of the United States into Afghanistan about whether that should be a military movement or a police action. But I want to go back to you, Glenn Salmasi, and get a response not only from what Mary Ellen O'Connell just said from you, and we want to get to our callers here, and we'll do that forthwith, but I'm going to read an email from a listener named Colin who writes, from the start, the Department of Justice has claimed that these powers are above the law and are utterly secret even from the courts. As the memo and other disclosures have shown, President Obama's view is that due process occurs when he meets secretly with a handful of people and acts as judge, jury, and executioner. With an entirely secret program hidden from everyone except the president, a few aides, and the hitman, who would resist? Who would know? And more to the point, who would know whether they were right or wrong? This is not democratic, nor is it constitutional.
Well, Colin asks a great question. I'll get to that in 1 second, but I did want to go back to Mary Ellen's. We have to look specifically at what they're talking about when they're saying fighting the battlefield anywhere, any place. The memo is very specific to say what we're talking about, and consistent with international law, if we're going to engage in one of these attacks, is that principles of sovereignty and neutrality will be maintained. And that meaning many of these countries actually consent to us having these drone strikes within their countries. And that's not something they want to let their people know, and it can hurt our international relations. But they engage in discussions with the State Department to permit this activity to take place. The second one, which is one that's probably more concerned to some, is that the host nation is unable or sometimes unwilling, maybe being intransigent to U.S. interests, to stop the threat posed by this individual that's going to be targeted. So I think that's one item. And the second item is, remember, we're not talking about putting in enormous amounts of troops. One of the things this administration has done, different from the Bush administration, is the increased use of drones to not have armed forces, boots on the ground, ships in at anchor or firing on land. It's actually using these unmanned drones to conduct operations. So there isn't that appearance, sense, or actual effect of having military forces engaging in a warfare-type scenario. So I'd almost argue, Mary Ellen, that this is becoming, that the drone is kind of trying to meet the need of not making it, is that hybrid that I've been speaking about, a hybrid weapon for a hybrid war. It's not really military, and it's not really law enforcement. It's somewhere in between the two that's taking place. So I just put that out there to respond. To Cullen's point, actually, the president has gone to great lengths, and the administration, including Attorney General Holder, to speak with the Senate Intelligence Committees. A lot of these briefings are done in private, but there are people from both sides of the aisle, Republicans and Democrats, who have listened to and have been briefed on the activities. And that's been said consistently, and there hasn't been just getting in a back room and talking to people. I understand that can be the concern, and is conveyed by some as being that the case. But we have to give credit where credit is due. President Bush did not do that, and nor has President Obama. They've gone to great lengths to maintain the secrecy of these operations, but at the same time ensure people are briefed and try to provide as much sunshine as possible to let people know what is taking place. And this being one of them, we're looking right at a legal rationale for a memo for really, it looks to be, their use of drones. And people are seeing that one way or the other. They are seeing that right now.
And again, Glenn Salmasi is professor at the U.S. Coast Guard Academy, Homeland and National Security Law Fellow at the Center for National Policy in Washington, D.C. Let me bring our callers into this, and we go first to Sacramento. Timothy, join us.
Hi, thanks for having this discussion. I appreciate you having me. So my question is, how does this new leaked white paper, which isn't even a public law, how does it relate in the context of the Patriot Act and the NDAA? Because we cannot consider this legal document in a vacuum. It exists in a previous context. Thank you.
Yeah, good question. Gunsel Mason?
It is. This is just we're getting an insight into what the rationale was for support of an operation. How does it interact with Patriot or NDAA. You know, I think right now this is purely for the specific issue. Does it have anything binding? No, but it does give us an insight into what the rationale is behind those attacks. And potentially, if someone was to pursue an action against the administration in some form or fashion, you'd have evidence of what they were thinking. But I do want to reiterate, and Attorney General Holder has said this several times, this is a draft. It is something that is, you know, it's a white paper. It's not the policy of the administration. It hasn't been written as such. It's stuff that we're getting insight into the legal rationale and support for their activities.
And it's a leak, I think.
Exactly.
We need to mention that, too, shades of Julian Assange. You going to add something here, Mary Ellen O'Connor?
Yes. Well, first, I thought Mr. Wirth's comment about it being a leak were very interesting because it's not clear to me who really benefits by this leak. As he said, it might lead tomorrow will be the hearings for Mr. Brennan, the beginning of his hearings, and Mr. Wirth seemed to imply that it may help Mr. Brennan because he can talk more freely about the policy. I thought it might have been leaked by somebody who is completely dismayed by the flimsy, self-contradictory, and in many instances completely incorrect analysis of the law. I mean, there's a complete misreading of the Hamdan case in terms of what the Supreme Court said about where a battlefield is and where it's acceptable to do military detention and military trials. So I thought that it was by somebody who was dismayed with all of this killing, but Mr. Wirth seems to suggest, and this would be more consistent with the Obama administration, that they somehow think this is going to help them. But it's and then Glenn keeps emphasizing that it's only a white paper and a draft, but I think he'll agree with me. We both have studied, I'm sure, very closely the 7 speeches given by top Obama administration officials, 3 lawyers, and Mr. Brennan.
Sounds an awful lot like this.
I'm sorry?
They sound an awful lot like this.
Yes. I mean, so, there, you know, as I said before, there's no real surprise. And as you've also heard from Glenn and me, this isn't, you know, the big difference in the document that I keep comparing this white paper to and the 7 speeches is the Bush administration's attempt to defend the use of harsh interrogation. They also came up with these secret memos, but we didn't know that these kinds of methods were being used. There were hints here and there, but they were not done in public the way bombing and missile launches are. And I think there was a real, it was really the disclosure of those secret memos that confirmed the practices were going on and led to President Obama stopping them. We don't need to see the secret memos to know and to be able to assess whether a missile strike in rural Yemen is lawful or unlawful under the law of armed conflict, under the UN Charter. And that's really the essential law. And as I said before, it's not law that the U.S. makes by itself. It's law that governs the relations among nations and therefore has to be made by that community of nations. So I think it's these documents are serving the same purpose that the torture memos did, what we now know as the torture memos, and that was to give the operators some sense of legal cover. We know there are a number of lawsuits now going forward. Officials in the UK have already said that they wouldn't dare take part in attacks like this because they would face criminal liability. So there are plainly some people wise enough to say, can we carry out these launches? CIA agents who are operating in Langley, who are conducting the missile strikes. So it looks like these memos have been written for the same purpose as the torture memos by requested by the CIA. So that
seems to me there's a definite parallel there.
Yeah, and it's a very unfortunate one.
I want to bring in more of a listener response. And let me, before I go to another call here, read some of the emails that are coming in because they have different shades and nuances that add a great deal of dimension to the conversation. Aaron writes, I fail to understand how this can be legal. Don't these individuals targeted to be killed even get a fair and open trial? Are they civilians or are they something else like spies? Even then, don't they get a trial? What legal protections do we have to prevent the U.S. government from doing this here inside our borders? Rick writes, it's hard to accept the loss of a child, even the 16-year-old child of a terrorist. However, if we tie our hands publicly, the terrorists will take advantage of this weakness and always have a child or two in their presence, just as Hamas, Hezbollah, and other vile groups already do. How can we reconcile this problem? And Paul says, what's the difference between the FBI killing a man in a bunker holding a 6-year-old hostage and drone attacks to take out terrorist leaders? Sam writes on our website, in certain respects, it is more troubling from a human rights perspective than that the U.S. military is redefining civilians as enemy combatants simply for being within a certain radius of an assumed terrorist. Killing an American terrorist may be unconstitutional, but deeming that a foreign civilian is a terrorist and killing him without reason is a war crime. The U.S. has more to answer for than breaching its own citizens' constitutional rights. It has also breached basic human rights. And Veronica writes on our website, would we do this to mafioso or anyone in a drug cartel? They have arguably killed more people in the U.S. than Al-Qaeda. Bob says, does the Chinese government have the right to kill a Chinese national on American soil if they deem him a threat to China? Of course not. So you get a whole range of responses here that I just wanted to kind of spectroscopically offer into the fray here. LeBrian writes, the guest talks about different laws for a different world, but the history of law is not something that is redesigned as the world changes. Law is built on history. Law is a continuous line to the ancient concept of justice. Indeed, there is nothing new under the sun, and there is no need to throw out 2,000 years of steadily evolving jurisprudence. Let me bring another caller on, and this is a caller from New Orleans. Julianne, hi. You're on the air. Join us, please.
I am here. Can you hear me?
Yes, fine.
Okay. My husband is an officer in the military. He was originally a German citizen who became a U.S. citizen and got his master's at Tulane in history. He just left Saturday to go to Kuwait for a year, and he's been in Afghanistan before in a heavily militarized zone. This year, he will not be in such a, it's really not an area of warfare. But we talk, and we've read about this issue, and my thought is that in the course of history, millions of people have died in traditional warfare, both soldiers who all have families and children and parents, as well as many, many civilians through the course of traditional warfare. And I just wonder, this is truly such a different war than we've fought in most of history. If we continue to increase the quality of our intelligence and have the opportunity to target a much smaller number of people that maybe would have a bigger effect on controlling the situation, I don't know that we'll ever resolve the situation that we're in. But you know, I'm a healthcare provider. I don't want anyone killed or injured. But you know, I just wonder if this doesn't make sense. Yeah, I wonder how current and how progressive the UN's policies are, and I just wonder.
Well, Mary Ellen, excuse me, Julianne, I appreciate your call and your thoughts. They go sort of in sync with Professor Solmacy's. But Glenn Solmacy, you know, she brings up a particularly interesting point in terms of our intelligence improving, and yet we keep hitting wedding parties in Afghanistan. There happens to be a large congregation of people, and all this collaborative damage occurring. It's pretty serious.
The collateral damage is always something that U.S. military tries to mitigate and minimize at any situation. And it is, though. It's horrifying. And we see it now because we're able to see it through the media channels and through social networking sites of what's taking place. And our reaction to it is immediate. But there are great lengths taken, regardless of how you feel about it, by the U.S. Armed Forces in particular, to minimize these. There's no question about that. But I do wanted to touch what we're hearing about and hear the different emails you'd receive, Michael, and what we're thinking here. Look how confused our policy still is 12 years later. We have the 9/11 attackers, the masterminds behind 9/11, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed et al., being tried by military commission down in Guantanamo Bay still, and Guantanamo Bay is open. Abdulmutallab, the underwear bomber in Michigan, is in federal court, as Mary Ellen said. So he tried to attack the United States in a similar fashion to plane, but he's being tried in federal district court with all the constitutional rights associated with a U.S. citizen. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed et al. Is in Guantanamo Bay before a military commission and not having it under a military justice system, essentially engaging in similar activity, not to the effect that the 9/11 folks have, but Abdul Muttalib is a similar, using an airplane to engage and use it as a warfare tool. And then on the third prong, we say we're not going to talk to them at all or capture them. We're just going to kill them with a drone. And that's the third prong. So really, I think we're still struggling, regardless of what the previous email said about law being consistent and staying the same and static. It always has to evolve and morph and mature. And if you look at what we've done as a society, the United States since 9/11 has recognized that terrorism can no longer be treated like a crime. It no longer is being used that way. It's not like the mafia. It's not like the fellow in Alabama. It's much broader, much deeper. It's now acting as if it is an armed force. And we've awakened to that strategically by creating the Department of Homeland Security, the Director of National Intelligence, etc. Tactically, we've changed the way we fight. As the caller said, we're using the FBI and the CIA more with armed forces than ever before. We use the surge different ways. We're working with human rights groups where the military hadn't before. So strategically and tactically, we've changed, morphed, and adapted. The only thing we haven't is matured our legal systems best to meet this need. We haven't matured our legal rationales and our laws.
I think you're suggesting we're kind of in a legal muddle in all this.
Yes, sir.
Well, I have to disagree with that. The one thing that doesn't change, despite the facts and despite changing situations, is how we make the law.
Mayor O'Connell, excuse me for interrupting, but ask you to hold that thought for just a second, because I have to do a station ID here, and I have to remind listeners that you are listening to Forum, talking with Mary Ellen O'Connell and Glenn Solmacy. We spoke earlier with Robert Wirth, and this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, simply go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. Sorry, back to you, Professor O'Connell.
Well, of course, the world is always changing. There's no doubt about it. Glenn is absolutely right about that. The nature of warfare is changing. My husband's time liberating Kuwait will be different from the caller's husband's time in Kuwait now. But we have methods for making the law, because the emailer is quite correct. If the law changes suddenly, then there's no purpose to it. The way we distinguish between those complying with the law abiding, and the criminals, the law breakers, are the ones who disregard because it doesn't suit their immediate self-interest to do whatever they want. And if that sounds like, yes, the United States is breaking the law because it's decided that it's better to use military force against small groups of criminal suspects in non-armed conflict zones, the U.S. is the one that has suddenly changed the law instead of saying, making the case for the world, we need a new treaty, etc. But I don't think we do. There's certainly plenty of evidence from all of the strongest counterterrorism experts that you use law enforcement. I agree with Glenn that what the president seems to be trying to do with the drone policy and not introducing large numbers of troops is to blur this line between military force and law enforcement. But people should not be confused about this. A 500-pound bomb is not a weapon permissible to law enforcement. A missile, a Hellfire missile, may not be fired by criminal investigators. We would not tolerate that in this country. Why should other countries that are also struggling to build a criminal justice system, a law and order system, have their attempts, their working toward having law and order, disregarded because the U.S. wants dramatic action now? Sadly, I think so many of these decisions are made for short-term political reasons and not because the president or members of his administration really want to build the rule of law in the world and help build criminal justice systems in the countries where we're attacking.
I think we could do a whole program on the distinction between the legal and political facts that we're wrestling with here. But let me bring another caller on. Wyatt, that's you. Join us, Wyatt. Hi.
Hi. I'm calling because I'm basically going to agree with the professor. What is it?
Which professor? We got two of them.
The male. I'm bad with names.
In
terms of the changing nature of war justifying outlandish actions, in World War One, we only saw limited attacking of civilian populations. But once heavy bombers became available, Dresden was burned simply because they thought it would decrease the morale of the troops, and they actually did of the Germans actually did the opposite. But irregardless, military zones, I mean, we didn't have troops, you know, attacking Dresden and whatnot. So the battlefield, I think, is expanded. And also I'd like to add that these situations, these terrorist actors, are what I would say is pre-rebels or they want civil war in the countries that they're acting in. And we just have the luxury of being the strongest military power right now and not being threatened by the countries they're taking over. So it's a really intricate question, and I think it's actually determined by where we stand in the world. And that talks to the immediacy of the imminence of the threat. I'll take any comments.
Okay, I thank you for the call. I think that's again to you, Mary Ellen O'Connell.
I understand there's a lot of misinformation around, but it's simply not the case that there's no law for governing every situation that we're looking at now, and that there are not means for improving the law to the extent that it's not being complied with. I would have hoped more Americans would understand the compelling nature of the human right to life. That you don't decide because there's because the CIA has some intelligence that a person may be involved in planning a future criminal action, that we can launch a missile at that person and the people standing around them and kill them.
We've got only about a little over a minute left. I want to get a final response from Professor Solmasi, if I may. Glenn Solmasi.
One item, yes, thank you, Michael, is that I really value what the CIA has been doing and continues to do. They are also brave men and women like the armed forces trying to find their best way to find these people. And I think the president is relying on that. Intelligence is a difficult item, but it is critical in this war we're fighting. And the last item that I'd leave you with, Michael, and with Mary Ellen, is to think we've been using the term battlefield throughout the day and how this relates to the Bush Doctrine. But the word battlefield keeps emerging as we've been discussing this topic. And I think the real word is battle space, because war is changing. We don't bomb cities. We don't take out entire cities, though we have the capacity to. Wars now are different or changed. It's a battle space, including cyberspace. And we have cyber war will be a whole other topic to discuss.
Yes, that would be another topic.
We'll save it for another day. I think we'll have to conclude it here, but I want to extend thanks to both of you for a very vigorous and, I think, good debate here this morning. Mary Ellen O'Connell, again, is professor of international law at the University of Notre Dame Law School, and Glenn Solmasi is professor at the U.S. Coast Guard Academy and author of The National Security Court System. We also spoke with Robert Worth of The New York Times, and thank you for being part of this morning's program. We appreciate your being with us here. We're here with you every Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeated in the evening. Up ahead, we're going to talk about online dating. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.